Well, this evening then we shall be considering Ezra chapter 3. And if you have a Bible then, you might want to have it open at that point. Now, unless you live in a bungalow or flat, or you happen to be blessed with a super efficient memory, then you may be familiar with that almost proverbial experience of going upstairs in your house and then promptly forgetting the reason why you've gone upstairs. And either you stand there on the landing for a moment, racking your brain desperately before then shuffling back downstairs, hugely irritated with yourself, or perhaps more commonly, you don't even realise that you've forgotten and you happily get on with some other activity upstairs which wasn't the original reason you went there. And I suppose that there was the danger the Israelites would do something like that. There was the danger they would arrive back in Jerusalem now that the exile in Babylon was over, and that there in Jerusalem they would blithely get on with building houses and shops and city walls and so on, and they would forget the reason why they had returned to Jerusalem, namely to build God's temple. That was the danger, and it's a danger that kind of hangs over all these Old Testament books belonging to this period of history. Happily, however, it doesn't rear its head in Ezra chapter 3. There's no hint of that problem here. The business of building God's temple is very much to the fore here in this chapter. And that being so, I want us this evening to consider three matters. First of all, the role of the temple. The role of the temple. And this is verses 1 to 7. Now, on the face of things, these verses are a little bit odd, or at least what they describe is a little bit odd. Cast your minds back to that point almost a year ago when our old building, Greystone Hall, had been demolished and this site had been flattened and was ready for foundations to be dug and walls to be erected. And imagine at that point, impatience had kicked in. And on a reckless impulse, we had gone ahead and purchased this lectern, and we had come along to this empty site one Sunday morning, and we had shoved down the security fences, and we had placed this lectern somewhere around here on the site, and we had seated ourselves on the cold, dirty ground, and in those bare, unprotected, inhospitable surroundings, we had held a worship service. I'm sure you'll agree that that would have been a somewhat unconventional way to proceed. If any passers-by had observed it, they would rightly have concluded that those people at Newcastle Reformed Evangelical Church are completely bonkers. But actually, that scenario isn't a million miles removed from the one we have here in these verses. We read in verse 1, that in the seventh month, the Israelites gathered together in Jerusalem. We read in verse 2 that they built the altar of the God of Israel. And we then read in verse 3 that they set that altar in its place and began to use it. And at that point, surely we feel like clearing our throats and saying to Jeshua and Zerubbabel, hang on a minute, this may be a beautiful altar that you've just constructed, but haven't you forgotten something here? Isn't there something missing here? Wouldn't some walls come in handy? Wouldn't a roof be quite useful? Wouldn't some rooms be in order? Wouldn't a temple be appropriate? Don't you think you're rather jumping the gun here? Aren't you placing the cart before the horse? what's going on? I mean, we know that you can sometimes use a new building before it's been completely finished, but you can't use a new building before it's been started. You can't hold temple worship in a non-existent temple. And yet that's what you guys seem to be doing. What's happening here? Has the long journey home unhinged you or something? Has the strong Jerusalem air brought on a touch of lunacy? What is going on here? Why are you setting an altar in its place and beginning to use an altar before there's even a temple to house it? We feel like asking those questions. But actually, I think that when we reflect a little on the wider context here, we begin to see that this apparently unconventional approach isn't a mark of mental insanity, but a mark actually of spiritual health. You see, if we go back to the period prior to the exile in Babylon, those dark days when the Israelites' conduct offended and provoked God like never before. If we go back to that period, one of the ugly things we find in Israel at that time is this: a basically superstitious reliance on the temple. As though its very presence in their midst somehow guaranteed God's favor. And it didn't matter how they lived, and it didn't matter how they behaved, and it didn't matter that injustice and idolatry and sexual immorality were rife among them, because the temple was there. That was their attitude. The temple is here, therefore God must be on our side. You can read all about it in Jeremiah chapter 7. That's why in Jeremiah 7 verse 4 we have these words: do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. That was the attitude that prevailed in Jerusalem in those pre-exile days. The temple standing there in the middle of our city, that guarantees God's favor. But then you see, on one fateful day, Babylonian soldiers had marched into that temple. They had stripped that temple of all its valuable items. They had lit torches and they had set that building on fire. And the Israelites, as they were being led out of their city, with the smell of the burning temple wafting into their nostrils, they had realized too late that actually that building didn't guarantee God's favor. And it didn't mean that God was on their side. And it seems to me that here in these verses, these returned exiles are demonstrating that they have learned that lesson. They are effectively saying here, the crucial thing, the really crucial thing is not the presence of a building. No, the really crucial thing is a relationship with God comprising worship and obedience and communion. And as long as we have an altar, as long as there's an altar, then we can worship with burnt offerings, verses 2, 3, 4, and 5. And we can obey what is written, verses 2 and 4. And we can, in the midst of our fears of the surrounding peoples, verse 3, commune with the God who has promised to meet with his people at the altar, Exodus 29:43. And yes, an unhoused altar without a roof over it might be a bit strange. And yes, ideally, it should be situated within a temple building. And yes, therefore, we shall get on and construct that temple building as soon as is logistically possible. But unlike our forefathers, we don't have this superstitious attitude that the temple kind of magically imparts some protection and power to us. We don't have this attitude that the temple is some omen of special divine blessing. No, the temple is a means to an end. It is of value insofar as it facilitates a relationship with God comprising worship, obedience, and communion. And if necessary, that relationship with God can exist even without a temple building. And so I hope you see what I'm saying, that this very stripped down situation here in these first seven verses, at first sight it appears terribly odd. What are they doing? Worshipping at an altar with no building. But actually, it shows these Israelites have learned a lesson, and they understand now the role of the temple. They can view the temple soberly now, properly now, realistically now, as merely the means to an end that it is. It's there as a vehicle for a relationship with God. And they can have that relationship with God even without the temple. That, I think, is the point of these verses. Now you might say, well, what has this got to do with us this evening? There's no danger for us of having a wrong view of the temple. The temple's gone. We don't worship God at the Jerusalem temple anymore. But is it not possible that still there can be equivalents that we have a wrong attitude to? Let me identify a couple. What about, for instance, giving financially to the church? Is there not the possibility that we could start to view that as somehow guaranteeing God's favour? Well, I give this money every month to the local church. Therefore, God is automatically favourably disposed toward me. Now, of course, as we saw last week, giving to the Lord's work is a good thing. But it's only a good thing as a means to an end, as an expression of love and gratitude within this relationship with God. It's not a magical source of protection for us. The crucial thing is the relationship with God. Giving to the Lord's work fits into that broader context. Or another example, the Lord's Supper. Again, isn't it not possible that we could think, well, as long as I'm participating in this religious ritual month by month, or however often it might be, eating this bread and drinking this wine, it's guaranteeing God's favour. I'm sure there are many people who sit in churches up and down our land who think like that. But again, you see, the Lord's Supper, of course, is a good thing and a commanded thing for God's people, but it's a means to an end, isn't it? It's a means to deepening our fellowship, our communion, our relationship with our crucified Saviour, Jesus Christ. And it's the relationship that's the crucial thing. And we always need to guard our hearts, don't we? In throughout biblical religion, in both Testaments, Old Testament and New Testament, the important thing is never special rituals or special sites or special shrines or special buildings. The important thing is this relationship with God. That's the center of gravity. That's the focal point of biblical religion, being in that relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And so that's the first thing then, the role of the temple, not as some source of magical protection, but merely a means to facilitating a relationship with God. Secondly, this evening, the testimony of the temple. The testimony of the temple. We read then in, this is verses 8 to 11, we read in verse 8, don't we, that it's this very significant moment then, that in the second year, in the second month, Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and others with them made a beginning. They began to build God's temple. This is political party conference season, isn't it? I'm not sure entirely what goes on at these party conferences, whether behind the scenes and unreported in the media, there's actually some useful and meaningful stuff that happens. But certainly in terms of what we see or what we hear in the media, it almost always seems to be these very smug speeches by party leaders or other important figures in the parties, kind of talking about how well they're doing, and a lot of backslapping going on, a lot of self-congratulation. We're doing ever so well in this area and in this area and in this area also. And that seems to be the general tone, doesn't it, of these party conferences, certainly, as I say, the kind of public face of them. And you might have expected something of that attitude here amongst these Israelites in Jerusalem. Here they are, and just a few decades earlier, the most powerful man on planet Earth had destroyed their city and their temple. And it looked like there was no way back for Jerusalem and no way back for the temple. It looked like that was it. It looked like the nation had come crashing down forever and ever. No observer on that day when the Israelites were led away from Jerusalem and the city was razed to the ground, no observer would have betted anything on them ever coming back and rebuilding that city and that temple building. It just seemed like that was the end. And yet here they are, as I say, only a few decades later, and they are laying the first stone of the temple. And you might have expected then something of the party conference attitude. A lot of backslapping going on. Aren't we such a wonderfully resilient people that tyrant Nebuchadnezzar, he couldn't destroy us. Here we are and we've come back and we're rebuilding our city. Aren't we great? Aren't we indomitable? Haven't we shown such a dose of national pride here? Haven't we shown how strong we are as a people? We couldn't be crushed by a nation so much bigger and more powerful than ourselves. You might have expected that sort of attitude, but you don't get it, do you? That's not what we see in these verses. We do see them breaking into song. But the theme of their song, there in verse 11, is not how great we are. Isn't this temple a testimony to our resilience as a people? No, isn't this temple a testimony to the love of our God, Jehovah? That's the theme of their song, isn't it? This rebuilding, it's not a testimony to anything about us. It's a testimony to something about God. It's a testimony to his steadfast love, which endures forever. That phrase, steadfast love, we talk about it so often, don't we, when we're looking at the Old Testament. It's that covenant love. Chesed is the Hebrew word. God's covenant love. You might be familiar with the figure of speech known as tautology, where you have a single statement in which the same thing is kind of unnecessarily repeated. You have the same thing kind of said twice unnecessarily in slightly different ways. And that's kind of what you have in this little song here in verse 11, where it says, "For he is good, his steadfast love endures forever." We don't really need the endures forever bit, because that's precisely what God's covenant love is. It is a love that endures forever. So the song is kind of saying, his love that endures forever, endures forever. But of course, it's not here a clumsy, unnecessary thing. It's impressing this fact that God's love is the great thing here. That's the great reason why this is taking place. Because God's love is unique. God's love is incomparable. God's love is extraordinary. And why then are the Israelites going down that route? Why are they regarding this rebuilding project as a testimony to God's love rather than to their resilience? Well, the answer is, you see, they realize something. They realize that the destruction of that temple all those years before, it wasn't primarily a political phenomenon. It wasn't primarily a military phenomenon. Yes, that's how it may well have gone down in the annals of secular history. That's how the Babylonian historians would have recorded it. It was just a purely political and military thing. Nebuchadnezzar marching in and destroying that city and that temple building. But they know that it wasn't just military and political. They know it was divine. They know that behind what Nebuchadnezzar was doing, God was doing something. He was punishing them. He was punishing them for years and years and years, centuries even, of disobedience and rebellion and sin. The kind of attitude that we touched on a moment ago, that superstitious attitude that as long as we've got a bit of religion in our city, it doesn't matter how we behave, we can be immoral, we can flout God's commands, and it doesn't matter. That there'd been centuries of that kind of conduct, and in the destruction of the temple, God was punishing them for that. And it looked like he was divorcing them. You know how at Sinai he had entered into that covenant with his people, hadn't he? Which is compared so often in the Old Testament to a marriage relationship. God as the bridegroom and Israel as the bride. And there, on that day that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple, it looked as though he was divorcing them. And he had every right to do so, precisely because of the way they had been behaving all those centuries before. It wouldn't have been at all unreasonable. It was perfectly within his rights to do so. And yet what they are singing here in Ezra 3 verse 11 is that God's love is so remarkable, so extraordinary, it wouldn't contemplate divorce. It couldn't give them up finally and fully. It couldn't let them go altogether. It could banish them temporarily to a far off land. But then it had to recall them and it had to have the temple rebuilt, because that is the character of God's love. It's a love that will not let its objects go. It's a faithful love, a stubborn love, a persistent love, a jealous love. And so this first foundation stone of the temple, it's not a testimony to a wonderful spirit in the Israelites. It's a testimony to this unbreakable covenant love of Jehovah. And isn't our presence here this evening, as believers in Jesus Christ, as worshippers gathering here this Lord's Day evening, isn't that similarly a testimony to that same unbreakable love of God that has so often pursued us in our lives when we, like the Israelites, have failed drastically and dramatically and the relationship should have been ended, and God should have banished us forever and should have divorced us completely, but he hasn't, and he's brought us back, and we're still here tonight as his people. Isn't that remarkable? How come we are Christians tonight, after all these years, all these decades perhaps for some of us? It's not a testimony, is it, to our stickability, our perseverance. It's a testimony to this love of God that would not let us go. On numerous occasions, when we stupidly shook our fists in his face and marched off from him into all kinds of messes and disasters. And he would not let us go. Every time he's pulled us back. Our presence here tonight as believing people is a testimony to the steadfast love that endures forever. The role of the temple, the testimony of the temple. Thirdly, and finally, the modesty of the temple. The modesty of the temple. This is verses 12 and 13. Because as all this celebration is going on then, all this singing, suddenly and unexpectedly, another note becomes mixed in with the celebration, doesn't it? A note of sadness. We read in verse 12 that many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first house, wept with a loud voice. And presumably then, although it's not spelt out explicitly, presumably the reason for this is that they could already see, even from the foundations, that this structure was going to be an inferior one to its predecessor. It wasn't going to rival Solomon's temple. Perhaps the dimensions were obviously from the foundations going to be smaller. Perhaps it was just even the very material from which the foundations were being constructed. We don't know, but it was clear, it seems, already that this new temple was going to be architecturally inferior. Now, elsewhere in the Old Testament, particularly in the books of Haggai and Zechariah, this kind of attitude is presented as a problem. It's presented as a wrong attitude, a sinful attitude. The older Israelites shouldn't have been weeping like this at this new temple building. It's condemned as unbelief there in Haggai and Zechariah. An unbelieving failure to recognize that God is often at work in small things, in weak situations. He's not a God who is only at work, or even normally at work, in grand situations and impressive situations, but a God who is at work in the small situations. By weeping, by making a fuss, by comparing this new temple adversely with the old one, they were failing to recognize that. God doesn't need grand buildings to be at work. And of course, that's a lesson that we so often need to relearn, isn't it? When we come here on a Sunday, come here perhaps on a Sunday night, in the middle of the summer, and there's only a handful of us here, and the temptation to think, well, there's not much point us gathering. What's God going to do with a little meeting like this? Or the temptation for those of us who preach to think, when we're struggling in the pulpit, when sermons appear to fall flat, when we just can't find any fluency, any momentum, the temptation to think, what good is this sermon going to do? We constantly have to battle with that, don't we? In all kinds of spheres. This tendency we have to think that God is only at work when things are impressive and large scale and grand. And yet, the Bible everywhere points us to the opposite, that God is generally at work in the small things. He's the God who is never more at work than when a man is pathetically dying on a cross, on a garbage heap outside of Jerusalem. That's the way this God works. He works through weakness and apparent futility. So as I say, elsewhere in the Old Testament, this attitude, this weeping, this misery at the smallness of the new temple, it is condemned. Here, however, it isn't. There's no value judgment given here, is there, on this attitude? It's not assessed negatively, it's not assessed positively. And therefore, we can't really make that application from this passage. Really, all we can do then, as we apply Ezra 3, these last couple of verses, all we can do is focus on this idea that the rebuilt temple was not a grand building. It was not a superb structure. It was not an architectural phenomenon. It was modest. It was ordinary. It was unremarkable. And I think there's significance in that. I think, again, it brings us back to the theme that we've identified in our other two studies in Ezra so far. It taps into this idea of the whole homecoming of the Israelites to Jerusalem being unsatisfactory. Yes, exciting to some degree, the exile being reversed, the people coming home, but in another way, kind of unsatisfactory. Just a bit too small, a bit too unremarkable, a bit too unspectacular. We've seen it in terms of the numbers, haven't we? It was only maybe 50, 60, 70,000 people who came back from Babylon. Not vast numbers. And we're seeing it now within the building that they started to put up. It's not a vast building. It's not superbly impressive. And why is this then? Why is there this kind of nagging sense of anticlimax throughout the book of Ezra? Well, the reason, as we've said on more than one occasion already, the reason is that the book of Ezra is just one little episode in a much bigger story. The story of a greater homecoming. God bringing a people home from the real exile of a fallen world. Bringing a people home to the true promised land of that new creation. And you see, there in Jerusalem, the returning exiles were not going to meet with God in the immediate, direct way that Adam had done and which Adam had forfeited when he sinned in the Garden of Eden. This was not going to be the reinstatement of that intimate communion, God dwelling in that most immediate and intimate way with his people. Because that won't happen until finally we are brought to the true promised land at the end of history. And that's why this temple is modest. It's to shout that out loud and clear. That this is not Eden being restored. This is not that communion which Adam lost being regained. That will only happen when finally we are all ushered to our true home. And Revelation 21, verses 3 to 4, become true. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. And perhaps I'm wearying you with this application in these sermons on Ezra. But it does once more pose the question, are you part of that great homecoming? Part of that multitude no man can number, whom Jesus, through his shed blood at Calvary, is bringing home to the true promised land, to the true restored temple, where God will dwell with us immediately and intimately, even wiping our tears from our faces. Ezra is modest. It's unremarkable, because its purpose is to point us to something far, far bigger. Are you part of that? Amen. Let's close with Psalm 27. We're just going to sing one stanza. It's two verses. One.